when I got the call from the travel agent, and she said, oh, you're not going to be able to get back on your flight. And what do you do when you're going to have a nervous breakdown? You turn to jam making. There's no other way. There's no other way out of that. You make jam. You make jam.
This is the Deep in the Weeds podcast. I'm Anthony Huckstep. Over the summer, we're going to catch up with previous guests and share yarns from their lives in food. While many of us are dreaming about traveling again, Pierre Issa, aka Pepe Sayer, spent 3 months abroad during 2021, and he's got some stories to share. Pepe, how are you?
I'm good. Great.
You've spent a bit of time overseas, which many of us haven't done for a couple of years. What was it like being abroad?
Look, it was very interesting. It was, for example, it was my first time to France and in Paris, where there was no one at the Louvre. So you just walk down, you walk through the Louvre, and no one's there. it was very weird traveling the last 4 months in Europe. It was actually quite strange. You know, in some of the capital cities I was in, it was just empty. It was only locals. So I guess it's a bit like when you go down to the Opera House and you walk down there and there's just, oh my God, there's no one here. You know, so it was a bit like that. You rock up to the Tour Evil and there's no one there. It's just a ghost town. It's quite amazing.
What was the experience like for you? How did you feel given that you had the experience in Australia and you've arrived back since? Does it feel different with the citizens there as to Australia?
Definitely. I think it's true to say that we definitely are a few months, if not more, behind Europe or the parts of the world that I traveled, which was Europe, Middle East, parts of Asia, in comparison to what's happening there and where they're up to with the COVID versus where we're up to with the COVID. But I feel now we're sort of joining, like we're almost ahead of a lot of the places that I was in because of our vaccination rates. So when I first got back, as we're opening up, as we're discovering life with COVID, they'd already experienced all that. Like when you take into account England or when I went to London and Suffolk, they'd already, you know, that they were already past that. They weren't wearing masks anymore. There was no more check-in into venues or where you went out. You didn't have to show a vaccination to get into a restaurant. Like they were already past that. Where it's a good guide, like we're sitting here now going, oh, what do you mean no mask and no this and no that? Yeah, I mean, they've already, so you could say we're watching what's happening and our governments are putting into play what they're seeing overseas or what their counterparts over there are doing. So it's quite interesting, but you sort of don't understand that unless you were there watching it unfold and then you come back here and you're going, okay, well, we're about 3 weeks from them doing that, for example, you know, them changing what they're going to do, their strategies and all that.
I understand you went on a food production sort of self-education program while you were away. What did you learn?
Oh, my God, where do I start? I must admit, I've only been back, say, 3 weeks. I haven't really downloaded everything that I experienced when I was over there. I spent a lot of time. So it's important to say where I was. I spent a lot of time in Lebanon, and I was there during the olive harvest season, and then I was there from early July. So there was the whole summer fruits, and then the olive harvest at the end of the year in October, which was fascinating. And I spent a lot of time on a fishing boat every morning fishing for some beautiful beautiful fish for my lunch or morning tea. So that was quite good. And then I was, you know, off to Turkey to visit Soma from Efendi and restaurant, and he's one of the MasterChef hosts over there. So I went and paid him a visit and learned how to make Kaimak, which is like a clotted cream. And then, you know, went over to see Johnny at Fen Farm in England, and a few other places, a few other things I went to do. I went to learn or meet this cheesemaker at Helsinki University that made cheese from the milk. The cow, that the university has some cows right near the airport in Helsinki. So there was quite a lot that I was exposed to, and I was actually searching for them to learn as much as I could about food and different food movements, and also I was lucky enough to go to a few expos in Istanbul about food and how we're losing certain species because of climate change and because of mass fishing and food production. So it was really, really eye-opening for what I do, I guess, for a living, and what I believe in, and how I see the food movement, and what does sustainability mean in food. But also, you know, you have to also think about that when you have a city of, if you're living, say, in Sydney and you've got a city of 5 million people, it's very hard to go, okay, well, everyone should have an olive tree in their backyard, and then they should harvest that once a year and then go and press their own olives to have their olive oil. So there's also, you know, like you, when you're in a village and everyone's harvesting their own trees and taking them to the press, and you know, there's a stone press and they're waiting for their olives to be pressed, and then they fill up their tanks and take them home, and that's their olive oil for the year. I mean, it's very different than, say, when you talk about a city of 5 million or 10 million or 20 million, right? So it's you know, like we'd like to think that everyone in France makes their own cheese, or everyone in Italy or Spain, you know, makes their own olive oil, but they don't. You know, everyone's, a majority of people, you know, 99.999% of people buy it in, right? So there's that as well to consider.
On the surface, cheese making doesn't seem that far removed from what you do with butter. But what surprised you about what you've learned with cheese making?
I think, well, so when I originally went to Lebanon, I went there for on compassionate reasons. We had a death in the family. I had to look after my dad for a month because he couldn't look after himself. He has dialysis, and we didn't have anyone, you know, to do that. So I, out of myself and my siblings, I was in the best position to go over and do that. My other sister that lives in the UK, she went before me, and then I went and covered her. So we sort of tag teamed on that. But one of the plans, I knew I was going to be over there for a while, for at least a month and a half. So I'd planned to, I wanted to learn everything I could about the soft cheese they make in Lebanon. So I made it my mission to, you know, as soon as I got into the village, I was like asking everyone, oh, who makes cheese here? Who's got cows? Who's got, you know, like this sort of thing I would do here if I wanted to know something. And then, you know, every auntie in the village was sort of like, oh, I make cheese, and come. And another one would tell me, I make cheese. And then this person had cows. And so I'd go up. My morning would start, say, on the fishing boat, come off the fishing boat, try some raw fish. Then by lunchtime, I'm at one of the auntie's houses, not my auntie's, I mean, an elder in the village. And then they're teaching me how to make the cheese. And then it's like, okay, well, I need to see the cows. I want to meet the cows. And then, you know, by the time I found, oh, this guy, no, he adds water to his milk. You don't want to use his milk. And you got all that sort of stuff going on there. And then by the time you find, you know, and then it's like a, okay, well, we got to get to the bottom of this. So I decided, well, the only person that knows anything about anything is going to be the local priest. So I called up the local priest, and I'm like, Abuna Rene, like Father Rene, tell me, who's got the best milk in the village? And he's like, yeah, you only want to talk to this guy. You know, this is the guy. This is the guy. So I'd make my way. So I'd call them and introduce myself and can I come? But and then you can't come before 5:30 because that's when the milk comes. So you'd go get the milk. And so it was really, really good. It was really good to go back to that, because that's what it was sort of like in my childhood when I grew up in Lebanon. That's what it was like when we made yogurt or cheese or anything. You sort of had to go direct to the source to get the real beautiful produce. So it was, but it was very interesting because there was so many variables and it was so complex. So there was no fuel in Lebanon at the time. There was 1 hour of electricity a day. There was no fuel and no diesel. So what was interesting about it, and the inflation was like, it was 20 things. So their currency, so for every dollar, you bought 20 times more of their currency. So $1 was 20,000 liras, where when I was there 2 years ago, $1 was 1,500 liras. So the inflation was times 20. And so what was interesting about that is you saw how people couldn't, because they import a lot of their meat there, and so people couldn't afford imports anymore. So you saw a lot of people going back to the land, going back to, you know, the person with the piece of land that had chickens on it and had his own eggs became the only option for people to buy eggs. So the stores no longer were relevant in that sense, because people couldn't afford to go to the stores anymore and buy those staples. They were starting to go back to, you know, this guy up here has milk, this guy over here has eggs, this lady over here has, you know, grapes. So it really became like that. It was really fascinating to watch. And there was no fuel to do long trips. There was no diesel to run generators. Like one of the most amazing things I saw, I was in Byblos and I was walking along the cliff road going into the city, and there was some greenhouses there, and the guy was in the greenhouses and he had the plow attached to a donkey and he was plowing inside of the greenhouses. I mean, it was fascinating stuff. Like, that was just mind-blowing to me, because maybe to someone that lived there, that wouldn't have been that fascinating. I give you that. But to me, living here in first world country, I mean, it's not very often you see someone plowing the field with a donkey, you know, like it's not exactly the done thing. They have a tractor, they have a John Deere, you know, latest model. So it was very, very interesting living through that. And then because I got stuck there, because the border to Australia was locked, I ended up spending more time over that 4 month period of traveling, and then, you know, seeing a lot more of that as the economy got worse and worse and worse. You sort of went, wow, okay, this is very interesting, very enlightening. It definitely makes you think, from my point of view, it's sort of like, oh, back in Australia, if the economy did go bad, touch wood, or something did happen, this is, I'm learning now what to do. You know, this is a lesson in economics and business management that I went through.
Where do you see the future of food and primary production?
Definitely away from the way we're going now. I mean, we're sort of midway. When you go to Europe, you really feel like the packaged food, ready-to-eat food, the massive packaging, plastic and everything. Like, you're in a place like Zurich. I was in Zurich. I was in Switzerland. I walked into one of their supermarkets. I think they're called co-op stores. Everything's ready to eat. Everything's packaged. Everything's like mass amounts of packaging, which is sort of what we here in Australia have tried to move away from, I guess. There's a push to move away from that, but then we keep going back to that single serve, take home, throw in the microwave or in the oven, that sort of thing. And that in itself is, I see it as very unsustainable way of to eat. You just, that is like, it creates a lot of rubbish. It creates, it costs a lot more to do. People are paying more. So it's like all geared upon just mass disposable income, you know? So if we're training our uni students to eat like this, or people that live away from home to eat like that, let's just take that as an example. Zurich might be full of uni students, I don't know. But how are they going to eat when they're older? So we're not laying any great foundations. And we're talking about a first world country here, Switzerland. When you compare that to how you're eating in a third world country, we've got a lot to learn from how people that are not fortunate with their economic situation. So if you ask me what I learned, look at third world, how they're eating. And that's probably how we need to start eating, rather than going, we're rich, we can just eat everything. You know, like, you got to question that. You got to question that. Like, I walk into a supermarket here and I look and I go, oh my God, like, where is this all heading? Because you just got, everything's packed for, you know, your snow peas are packed in little packs of 100 gram. Like, oh, you're kidding. Look at all this packaging, you know, where Uber Eats, let's go, you know, everyone's got bags and bags and bags. I mean, if you order from anywhere, you got 3 bags. Like, there's a lot of rubbish, you know, there's a lot of rubbish generated here. That's a lot of energy that it took to make all this. So I don't want to sound like I've lost the plot, but, when it comes to sustainability, but wow, it's something I really noticed as soon as I left there. Say I left Lebanon and I went to Europe, I really noticed that. And then when I came back to Australia, I really noticed how much rubbish we generate for nothing. Like it's not keeping the product fresher or better. It's just consumerism gone, just for no reason. Just to make people buy more or up the spend on one unit. Like, oh, your meal tonight's cost you $9.95. But, you know, that rubbish that it generated, my God, what are you going to do with all that?
During this period of time, you became quite adept at jam making. How did that come about?
When I got stuck in, when I got the news, when I got the call from the travel agent, and she said to me, it was in sort of the middle of to the last week of August, I got the call. It was a horrible call, and she said, "Oh, you're not going to be able to get back on your flight to go back to Sydney." I said, "Well, when do I get back?" And she said, "Oh, the end of 24th of November." And I think I turned blue. I was going to have a nervous breakdown when I got that news. It was terrifying. And what do you do when you're going to have a nervous breakdown? You turn to jam making. There's no other way. There's no other way out of that, you know? Like, there's no other way, right, Hux? You make jam. You just, you know. So it was really interesting because I met, there's some family members that I met up with, and I was talking to about, you know, I'm stuck here and this and that. And when I was telling that, I was at their house and they were making jam. So I could smell the jam and I go, "What are you doing here?" And she goes, "Oh, I make jam." And I go, "That's not much jam you're making. It's like tiny. It's like, how many jars will that make?" And she said, "Oh, 3. And I go, "Okay, interesting. I thought, you know, you'd make in the season, say, of strawberries or prunes or whatever it is. You'd make quite a lot and save it for the winter." I thought that was the concept of jam making. And she goes, "No, that's rubbish." She goes, "I make seasonal and I make it weekly or bi-weekly. And she goes, and then I put as much sugar as I want. So if I'm eating my jam regularly, I don't need a lot of sugar in it to keep the to keep it from going off for 6 months or a year. So I reduce the sugar and I only eat what's in season, because there's an abundance, obviously, of fruit. Like take Australia, how much fruit goes to waste? It's incredible if you saw the numbers. And you could make seasonal and eat seasonally and make seasonal jams. And instead of having 50% or 30% or 100% sugar, you just reduce the sugar right down, and then you're not worried about it keeping, but you make it as if you're making a jam, but you make less. So I started learning about, well, every fruit's different. Like when we were making the quince, it was, you know, you do need a lot of sugar, unfortunately, for quince. But, you know, when you're making strawberries, like strawberries and raspberries mixed together, you don't need a lot of sugar. You can go with 10, 15% sugar and you can get this most incredible jam that lasts, say, a month. You know, you don't need it to last more than that anyway, if you eat a lot of jam. So it became a bit of an obsession, along with the cheese making, and then, you know, everything else I did was almost an obsession. I had nothing else to do except to work a little bit when you know, the time difference was, you know, I was still doing my part of my job, which is, say, marketing, doing the social media for Pepisea, doing the product development. And then, but at the end, Mel's here, and she took the reins over everything. So I was just reporting back to her with what needed to be done from my end, and she was doing the rest. I did have a lot of spare time.
A little earlier, you mentioned you were on a fishing boat. Tell me about the typical day on the boat.
Well, the day starts at 5 a.m. We'd get down to the Mina or the port, and then we'd jump on the fluka, they're called. They're beautiful little boats for the Mediterranean. And then we'd basically, you'd pack your coffee and your breakfast, and you get on the boat, and you go out. You don't go more than about 6 km offshore. Otherwise, you need another license. But after 6 km, you get all the tuna. But we were mainly going out for mac tuna, which is a small variety. It's a variety of tuna, which is beautiful raw. So mac tuna, people do cook it, but they a lot of people like it cooked. I think it goes a bit tough cooked. But raw, it is magnificent raw, whether you have it with, however you have sashimi, however you like it. I mean, I was having it because soy sauce wasn't available because it was they were in the middle of a crisis. You know, virgin olive oil, salt, pepper, and lemons, you know, and that was just mind blowing. So we'd get off the boat. We'd go out for about till 8:30, then we'd go back to the house. We'd skin it, you know, bone, cut it, all that, prepare it, and just eat it with just fresh lemon juice, olive oil, salt and pepper, in some Lebanese bread, and it was just to die for. It just melt in your mouth, and then straight after that, we'd be down for our 2K swim, and then after the 2K swim, it would be breakfast again. And then it would basically be jam making or cheese making most days. And then by then the Sydney office would be open. So Sydney would be open, and then I'd work in the afternoon with the guys. So it was quite good.
Given this extraordinary trip that you had and the experiences, how are you approaching Pepisea into 2022 and beyond? Has this experience affected the way you want to take the brand?
Yeah, it definitely has. It definitely has. I think that more than anything, I believe we're on the right track as being a holistic, batch-made butter that that we are. We haven't changed anything from that side of the business since we started. I'd like to continue like that and stay true to what we set out to do from the start. I think this experience has really, you know, brought that home for me as no, this is the right way to go. But as well, the fact is that from traveling so much, while I was there, you know, as I went out to Europe and I spent, you know, a couple of months traveling through Europe, or it was all up, I think it was over 2 months, but it was all up about a month and a half in Europe out of the 4 months. It definitely showed me that there's a big world out here, and they're most of the products that I came across in my travels were just mass produced products on shelves. Like it's very hard to find artisan products. That's what I saw.
How did it feel when you arrived back in Australia?
Look, it was great to be back. Even though I did have quite a good time over there, it's very, very hard being away from your family and kids. Let me put it that way. It's just like your wife and kids. It's like if they were with me, amazing. I would say, oh, you know, I'll see you in a couple of years. But it's not the case. It's a very hard thing to do. It puts a lot of strain on relationships, and it puts a lot of strain on your life. So your life is on hold for that period, and you're just filling up time, really. But to come back was incredible. Other than seeing Melissa and the kids and just wow, that was incredible. It was really, I had butterflies in the plane landing, thinking, wow, I can't wait to see them again. But also for me, when I walked into Pepe Sayre and I saw what we were doing after seeing all of that I saw, it was incredible, absolutely incredible what we do at Pepe Sayre. I thought, wow, you know, was that a free advert? Or are you going to cut that? You can cut that if you like. No, but it really was.
We might leave it in because it's true to the story.
No, it really was. It's sort of like, you know, like one of the best experiences I have, thanks to Soma, was when I went to see the buffalo farm and watch the lady make kaimak, which is like a clotted cream. It was about 2 hours outside of Istanbul. On a farm, and this lady that I went to visit, that he set me up with to go and visit the farm, was like, she goes, we don't take anything from the government, so no electricity, nothing. We're all self-sufficient on the farm, and it was wow. And then they have like 100-something head of buffalo that have to sort of roam a little bit free through water, all that sort of thing, to get the most out of their milk. And then she makes all these beautiful products out of it, like cheese and butter, and learning how to make that kaimak was just fantastic. Like that was a real eye-opener that, you know, there's still people out there living and wanting to make products like this, you know. And the mind-blowing thing about it, her products were just incredible, off the chart, the products she was making. And she's 2 hours from Istanbul, which has 22 million people in it, right? And she struggles to sell what she makes. Like that, I was just sitting there going, what do you mean you struggle to sell what you make? You're making a product like this. And she goes, yeah, but we don't know how to tell people we're here. We don't know, like they struggle on that sense. So, you know, because you can't be jack of all trades. You can't be this marketing, you know, whiz and then go out and try to sell a kaimak. And it's sort of like, you know, and then you go out there and you're twice the price because it costs you more to produce things. And you know, someone else is coming in from a massive, ginormous factory selling it to you cheap, cheap, cheap. So they really, you know, so these sort of problems that you're seeing is quite universal, you know. Like we have those issues here with people that make amazing stuff out in the bush and they come to the city and they can't sell them or whatever. So it's quite interesting. Or they get eaten alive by their distributor or whatever. So, yeah.
You're back in Australia in time for summer. How are you feeling about your summer this year in Sydney?
Let me say this. I'm having a never-ending summer, right? So from July through to October in the Northern Hemisphere, now Southern Hemisphere, you know, November, hopefully all the way through. I got asked the other day, are you going anywhere for the break? And I'm saying, no, I don't need a break and I don't want to go anywhere, you know? The furthest I want to go is like Coogee Beach. That's it. I don't want to go anywhere. It's sort of like I just want to stay put. So I couldn't think of anything better to do than just enjoy our city and the beautiful Sydney and Australia at the moment.
Well, Pepe, it's always an absolute pleasure to catch up with you. You've always got a story to tell and you're always digging beneath the surface, which is so amazing. Have a great festive season. Please keep in touch and we'll catch up again soon.
Thanks so much, Hux. Talk soon.
This is the Deep in the Weeds podcast. I'm Anthony Huckstep. Stay tuned as we take a deep dive into the lives of the incredible people who ply their trade in the food and hospitality sector. Special thanks to executive producer Rob Locke for making this all happen. Follow us on Instagram at Deep in the Weeds Podcast or email us at podcast@deepintheweeds.com.au. Stay safe and be well.